This week on the Northwest Politicast.
President Trump's pick for AG says the anti-weaponization fund is dead, but the president says otherwise, and Republicans on the Hill aren't happy.
Several Senate Republicans now saying they will likely support legislation to legally ban the president's so-called anti-weaponization fund.
But did they actually vote that way? Plus, the president's support within his own party appears to be slipping.
This is, though, a largely symbolic resolution. Four Republicans joining Democrats to limit the president, requiring him to remove U.S. forces from Iran.
And the effects of climate change are starting to affect businesses here in Washington state.
Washington is known as a water state, one of the wettest in the country. And yet drought is becoming more common, not less.
Now, here's Northwest News Radio's Jeff Pulgilla.
As always, a lot to get to this week, but we're going to begin in the other Washington. Thursday night into Friday morning, senators were up into the wee hours as they were voting on a number of things. Ultimately, approving a $70 billion immigration enforcement package that includes nothing to rein in the anti-weaponization fund that Donald Trump had pushed to support his allies that he felt were wrongly prosecuted by the Department of Justice under the Biden administration. To talk about this and more of the highlights from Capitol Hill over the last week, let's bring in Capitol Hill correspondent Ali Pekoran. And let's start with this vote in the wee hours of the morning and the weaponization fund. What happened there?
So for weeks now, senators have been trying to move forward with this massive package to fund immigration enforcement. It's about $70 billion, mainly directed at ICE and Customs and Border Patrol. Now, the underlying bill is something that most Republicans, in fact, nearly all of them, were very excited about and ready to get on. But things got very complicated over the last couple of weeks due to this anti-weaponization fund that the president decided he wanted as part of his settlement with the IRS. So a number of Republicans for weeks have been saying they have very serious concerns about that fund and wanted to use this bill and the hours and hours of amendment votes that were going to go on as part of it as an opportunity to try to address that fund. Now, ahead of the Senate vote, Deputy Attorney General, who President Trump is now planning to make the formal nominee to serve as the Attorney General, Todd Blanche, told lawmakers that the fund was dead, that it would not be revived. Now, that was enough for some senators, not enough for all of them. So what we saw overnight was a lot of efforts by Democrats and some Republicans to try to pass these different amendments that would restrict how this money in the fund might be paid out. Democrats brought forward an amendment that would have killed the fund altogether, and then we saw another amendment brought forward by Republican Senator Bill Cassidy that would prevent payouts to individuals who assaulted police officers on January 6th. There were a number of amendments to that effect as well. So there was a ton of grandstanding from Republicans about how they might not support this bill if it didn't do something to rein in this fund. Ultimately, none of those efforts were successful during this 18-hour vote marathon. There was a lot of talking, not a lot of success. So what the Senate ultimately greenlit was a bill that provides $70 billion for ICE, does nothing to address this fund. And even though there were a number of Republicans who said they were uncomfortable voting for it initially, we only saw one Republican vote against the entire package yesterday. That was Alaska Senate Republican Lisa Murkowski.
Does this mean that anti-weaponization fund, as the president has described it, is dead on arrival, like Todd Blanche said, or is this going to be revived, or is Congress going to weigh in with another bill?
Well, so at this point, what Congress has done is more or less washed its hands of this. So what they're saying is we trust Todd Blanche when he says that they're not going to bring this fund back to life. But Congress hasn't actually installed any guardrails preventing the administration from doing that. And this sort of was the big opportunity to do so. So the question here is really, do you take Todd Blanche at his word? And enough Republican senators evidently decided that they do. Now, this is an issue that probably isn't going anywhere on Capitol Hill because as President Trump is naming Todd Blanche to the role permanently, he's going to have to appear before the Senate to receive votes to be confirmed to that position full time. Now, if there's issues percolating regarding this fund, I would expect that some of those key senators may be reluctant to cast a vote in favor of Blanche's confirmation. So it could be coming back up here not too long from now. But at the moment, it's up to the administration how things proceed, because Congress did not ultimately act to place any guardrails around the fund.
And speaking of Todd Blanche, he also has the issue of the Jeffrey Epstein files that some Republicans on Capitol Hill not so happy about. So that adds to the complication in getting him confirmed.
Absolutely. That Pam Bondi testimony that came out over the last few days sort of indicated, at least she indicated, that Blanche may have had more of a role in the handling of the Epstein files than was publicly known at the time. Now, whether you take that testimony to heart or not is sort of up for interpretation. But obviously, for Democrats in particular, there's lots of reasons that they have some reluctance about Todd Blanche. And you're right, this is probably not going to help with his confirmation efforts in the Senate either. There are a number of concerns about Blanche's nomination that could hamper him as he moves through this process, including some comments he's made about January 6th. Senator Tom Tillis, who sits on the Judiciary Committee and actually has quite an ability to block or really, really stall Blanche's nomination at the committee level, has said that he won't support anyone who's spoken favorably about January 6th. And Blanche has made comments in the past that have definitely raised some eyebrows about that topic.
We're talking with Capitol Hill correspondent Allie Pekorin, and because we are the sports center of Congress, we're getting all the highlights of the last 7 days. There was also the war power resolution in the House voting to rein in the president on Iran, but that's really kind of dead on arrival in the Senate, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was still a pretty remarkable moment because it's just another indication of where we're seeing some Republicans, not all Republicans, not a lot of Republicans, but enough Republicans being willing to challenge the president's key authorities here. And so in the House, once again, we saw a small contingent of Republicans joining with Democrats to pass this resolution that would rein in President Trump's war powers in Iran. Now, the Senate has voted on similar legislation that over the course of 7 different votes did eventually gain some GOP traction. There was a vote in the Senate that did advance procedurally, but if every senator had been in attendance, it wouldn't have. So you're right. It's probably unlikely that this piece of legislation makes it to the Senate and is passed with any level of success, but it'll still be a really interesting watch as we watch more and more of those Republicans who are uncomfortable with what the president is doing in Iran sort of standing up to him.
And then on Friday, there was this headline: 4 Senate Republicans joining with Democrats to block the Save America Act. Now, this was the bill that President Trump wanted that would basically give federal control over state elections.
Yeah, so as part of that all-night voting marathon that was going on for the immigration enforcement bill we were discussing a little while ago, some of President Trump's key allies did bring forward amendments that would have attached some of those Save America Act provisions onto this bill. Now, as you know, as a person who watches Congress, a lot of these votes during these like long-standing Votorama series are performative or not really meant to actually pass. So even as these were being brought up, the senators who brought them forward knew they weren't going to pass. That doesn't mean that it wasn't an opportunity for those Republicans to challenge Trump to cast votes that were pretty standout. And this is a key priority for the president, the Save America Act. He's made it very clear that he wants to do more to sort of increase photo ID and voter ID and pass some of these restrictions on voting. That's something the president has really put front and center. And so asking these vulnerable Republicans to stick their necks out on that was not a small thing. And yes, he did criticize those 4 Republicans who voted against the legislation.
And I would imagine that Democrats are happy not only because they were able to block the SAVE Act, but they also got the Republicans on record as supporting it in an election year.
Yeah, and that is sort of the like dynamic that's at play anytime that we do one of these like all-night voting marathons. It's not so much about actually legislating on these topics that they're voting on as it is about forcing your opponent to cast pretty politically difficult votes, right? So if you're a Democrat, we saw tons of bills come up about lowering prices for consumers, lowering the cost of healthcare and housing and things like that. None of those bills really stood any chance of being attached to this larger package, but Democrats were still very eager to get their Republican colleagues on the record as voting against some of these ideas. The same can be said for what happened with the Save America Act. And the only difference here is that because some Republicans did choose to vote with Democrats on this, it is creating a small fissure in the party.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. The Scott Van Pelt of Capitol Hill, Allie Pekorin, with all the highlights of the last week. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come.
President Trump's former national security advisor pleads guilty to a federal crime, just as a new AG tries to get confirmed.
When the Northwest Politicast returns after this.
Welcome back to the Northwest Politicast. I'm Jeff Pogela. After the Department of Justice announced this week, former National Security Advisor John Bolton will plead guilty for mishandling classified information, the president seems keen on making his acting attorney general permanent. So let's bring in ABC's Peter Haralambos and two things that are important for context. John Bolton worked for the president, and Todd Blanche doesn't have an easy path to confirmation, considering other recent developments.
A kind of a firestorm of news out of the Department of Justice as Todd Blanche is trying to make this ascension from acting attorney general to the permanent posting. And of course, he's been facing bipartisan uproar at this point over the handling of that so-called anti-weaponization fund. However, I'll note that in the eyes of Donald Trump, the audience of one that was kind of critical for Todd Blanche to get this permanent nomination, he did have a success in the eyes of the president in securing this guilty plea from former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Bolton, of course, the former National Security Advisor during Trump's first term, someone who's now considered one of Trump's political opponents, given his outspoken criticism of the president. This was a controversial case, and we learned that Bolton, rather than fighting it, was going to agree to plead guilty to one count of retaining classified information. He faces a $2.25 million fine, as well as the possibility of up to 5 years in prison.
Now, even Blanche says the anti-weaponization fund is dead, and President Trump has been providing mixed signals on this issue, and that led to a lot of criticism from senators as well.
He continues to face criticism and skepticism, even from the Republican side of the Senate. Of course, he needs a majority in the Senate to move forward, and that fund really irked leadership and some influential Republicans. John Thune, for example, when asked about this, he didn't have a firm answer in terms of whether or not he thought Blanche would get confirmed. And then on top of that, he still hasn't confirmed in writing that they're going to get rid of this anti-weaponization fund, fueling further skepticism. On top of that, just 2 days ago, President Donald Trump, when asked about this in the Oval Office, suggested that he still thinks January 6ers should be still paid and reimbursed for their troubles, suggesting the Department of Justice might try to find another way to do this, despite Todd Blanche's vow that the fund is dead.
And it's not just that anti-weaponization fund. Senators seem to be unhappy with Blanche, whether it's having been the president's personal attorney in the past, the Epstein files, or something else. So he doesn't seem to have a lot of friends on the Hill that he will need if he is to be confirmed.
Yeah, and for any criticism you might have of the Department of Justice over the last year under Attorney General Pam Bondi, a lot of that blame could shift over to Todd Blanche because she was his deputy for that entire time period. In fact, yesterday, the House Oversight Committee released transcripts from their interview with Pam Bondi as part of their Epstein probe. During that interview, Bondi repeatedly said that it was Blanche who was effectively in charge of the entire release of the Epstein files. She kind of distanced herself from the more controversial elements of the botched release of those files and suggested it was really Blanche who was in charge at the time. She pushed back on criticism that she was blaming Blanche and said she thinks he did an excellent job. But of course, that's just yet another hurdle that might get in the way of Blanche's confirmation. On top of that, he, of course, was Donald Trump's personal defense attorney for a year, battling three of his indictments. And there's criticism that he's kind of still serving as Trump's personal attorney, given this increased role Trump has taken overseeing the Department of Justice himself.
All right, ABC's Peter Haralambos, thank you so much for your time and insight.
Coming up next,
how climate change is making trouble in Eastern Washington.
When the Northwest Politicast continues after this.
Welcome back to the Northwest Politicast. I'm Jeff Pogela. Finally this week, over the past couple of months, we've shared the stories of lower than normal snowpacks and the fear that water will be in short supply later this summer. That's particularly troublesome for farmers in eastern Washington. And the unseasonably warm temperatures earlier this week likely didn't help. Let's get more from Northwest News Radio's Brian Calvert.
It seems like the warnings come earlier each year, and on the hottest day so far this year in Spokane, that city's residents are being told water restrictions are now in place.
Our river always, typically always, hits a drought level at some point during the summer. That's expected to happen. It kind of just depends on when. Sometimes it's July, sometimes it's, you know, middle of September.
Kristen Davis with the city tells KXOY she acknowledges it's not even officially summer for a few weeks, but says starting this week, they're at level one water restrictions already. That means no outdoor watering during the warmest part of the day from 10 a.m. till 6 p.m. Add that to water restrictions already in place in Lacey and Bainbridge Island.
Washington is known as a water state, one of the wettest in the country, and yet drought is becoming more common, not less.
In April, Washington State Ecology Director Casey Sixkiller warned 2026 was looking pretty bad for the snowpack. Less than a month later, he said this.
Today, we are gathered again to declare a drought emergency for the fourth year in a row, and this time it is statewide.
That was early May. The Washington Water Supply Outlook Report as of May 10th shows statewide snow water equivalent, a key measure of water stored in snowpack, at just 42% of normal. Despite near to above normal precipitation since the start of the water year in October, officials say a snow drought has taken hold.
In the winter, we're getting more rain and less snow, which means greater flood risk and less natural storage in the mountains. In the summer, hotter and drier conditions leave communities, farms, and fish competing for less water.
And it's not just here. In early May, Oregon's governor listed 12 of her counties under drought emergency conditions.
And the science confirms this is our new normal.
So now what? In a part of the country where agriculture and the outdoors are so much a part of our livelihood, you can't just throw up your hands and say the sky is falling. The snow surely isn't. There is now a movement in motion to get items in front of lawmakers next year to address this.
Washington's water future is designed to bring people together from across our state. Communities, tribes, farmers, businesses, utilities, environmental groups, and local leaders to help shape a path forward for people, fish, and farms.
And the questions will likely include, if the water isn't coming from the sky or the mountaintops, how do we adjust down here at sea level? Governor Bob Ferguson.
These roundtables will be taking place all across the state this summer. I also asked Casey and Ecology to work with other state agencies to discuss ways to innovate and improve how we serve communities. And by the end of the year, Ecology will bring a report to me with recommendations on steps we can all take together to put new ideas into action.
Information and dates on future roundtable conversations about water posted soon on the Department of Ecology website. Brian Calvert, Northwest News Radio.
And that'll do it for this episode of the Northwest Politicast. Thank you for spending part of your day with us and for following the discussions, debates, and decisions shaping politics and public policy across the Northwest. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, follow, and leave a rating and a review in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. That helps more listeners find us, which keeps this civil conversation going. You can also share this episode with someone else who cares about the topics we discussed today. I'm Jeff Pogelet. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week.